Hello, welcome to the Dance Futures podcast, the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. For the November edition, I am talking to interdisciplinary artist, educator, activist, and embodiment researcher, Camille Barton. This episode does come with a trigger warning. We discuss Camille's experience of miscarriage. So if that's a difficult subject for you, I recommend skipping forward to about 50 minutes where you can enjoy some of the additional content with myself, Robin and Luca, my double shots of espresso. Also, I'd really recommend checking out Camille's DJ work after this if you need your daily dose of bass. Camille, am I pronouncing that correctly? Or is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. So I wanted to ask you, maybe you don't even refer to your work as a practice because you have like so many strands. But I suppose I'm interested in particular in your kind of movement and embodiment work in the context of this podcast. So I wondered how you might kind of describe that as a practice. If you had to talk to somebody about it for the first time, maybe who isn't in that world so much, how do you talk about what it is that you do?
Good question. In terms of my movement work, I suppose I'm interested in using certain techniques and body-based processes to sort of check in with my nervous system, to allow my nervous system to, I guess, relax, might be a simple way to say it, and to be more aware of where stress is impacting me, where I might be holding that in my body, and then using, dancing or mindfulness practices to kind of help repattern or move that, shift those uncomfortable parts that might be coming up, but also to connect to joy and connect to, feelings of satisfaction. Basically trying to notice what my experience is moving through the world and how that's relating to my body.
And presumably, do you also then kind of facilitate or help to support other people through those experiences as well? Or is it more of a personal practice for you?
At the moment, it's quite personal. For many years, I was running group sessions that I was calling Embodied Social Change. And those were much more focused on feeling into the ways that predominantly racism or ableism or sexism impact the body in our ways of relating to other bodies. As my projects have kind of shifted in the last years, plus with the pandemic, I'm just working quite a lot on my own at the moment. But also doing similar embodied social change kind of workshops with the students I have on the master's program I'm leading. So I'm kind of working with them a little bit, and then otherwise mostly with myself at the moment.
Well, it's a good reminder though, isn't it, as well, that if you're a teacher or if you're holding space for people, that being resourced and understanding your own needs is a really great way to also share that with others, right? It's an important thing. So in my little digging around of your website and all the wonderful things that you do, I guess I was curious in the journey, and again, I feel like this might be taking you on a bit of a historical thing before we get to the future, because obviously, as you said, your projects have shifted, but I was interested that you've kind of explored a few different dance styles. You know, you'd very much call them like styles, like you said, like hip hop and belly dance and maybe salsa even was on there, I think. And so I'm sort of curious about your journey from like practicing these quite specific styles to then this more open sort of embodiment. I can see you. I'm like, it's a podcast and people can't see your expression. So you've got that okay, casting your mind back.
There's so much. I'm going to try and make it concise. I suppose, so the first dance form I really did for a long time was ballet. And I studied that from the time I was 3 until I was about 15. But I was having struggles with it as a teenager. As many people listening who've done ballet might be aware of, it's a very rigid form. And you're really told you either have the right body for it or the wrong body for it. And if you're in a black body like mine, you often don't have the right body for ballet. So I was feeling that a lot as a teenager, this sense of either having to really contort myself, work twice as hard to kind of, you know, receive any praise. I also felt like my teacher was quite kind of picking on me quite a bit. And it, I think maybe from her, I was coming from a place of love, because she also, although she's white, she had a much bigger body than you'd normally see for ballerinas. And so I think she saw in me, oh, there's talent there, but I have to push Camille really hard, you know, and it just wasn't working for me anymore. So I left that and really began to transition much more towards dance forms that just felt good. And for me, feeling good was about like getting into my hips, allowing my spine to undulate and to move. And so I feel like from my departure from ballet, I suddenly went just way towards the various dances of the African diaspora and the ways that spirals and undulations and rotation and circles are so much more of a kind of pattern. So to me, although the styles I've done seem quite different, to me there's a core running through them that they're dances of the diaspora, and they have these rhythms and these this conversation with polyrhythms and the kind of different movements in the body and parts of the body that get activated when we are moving away from straight lines and going towards circles and spirals. So I see a connection there, and that's been my kind of interest since kind of leaving ballet, because it really allowed me to start connecting to pleasure in my body again. And due to trauma history, I've had a lot of dissociation in my life, and so actually finding and locating pleasure in my body has been a really important avenue to starting to just regain sensation generally, and to actually learn what feeling good feels like on an embodied level.
Because
for so many of us that don't feel safe in our bodies, it's like, how do we even cultivate that sense of safety? And so pleasure has been a big part of that for me.
I love the way you articulate that, Camille. And there's so much there in terms of even like dance pedagogies, when you describe, okay, maybe the intentions were essentially good from your ballet teacher, but this notion of sort of pushing and striving and working harder, you know, versus this kind of more pleasure, more joyful orientated sort of practices, but also how that is manifest in the very sort of nature of the movement, the choreography, the kind of impulses, the shapes, the patterns, as you say. And I think that's such an important recognition for all dance practices, actually, because they get very removed from the macro sort of political world. And it's like, oh, it's just happening here. But actually all those things, all those things kind of feed back. And even so, even the way we're moving has this kind of ripple effect. So yeah, it's really lovely to hear you talk about that. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
The other thing, this is probably like my own little personal thing that I was curious about. And again, if somebody looked at, I don't even have a website actually, like when you write things down and then people go, you said this once upon a time in 1985, and then you're like, oh crap, I don't relate to that anymore. So forgive me if it's one of those. But you use the word fusion on your website around that. And there's always been a kind of, I don't know, it's been one of those words, maybe even with food, where I'm like, no, I can't cope with this word. And I wondered how whether you still relate to it, what that means to you. And I suppose my reaction to it is around that somehow difference gets like subsumed into this sort of like thing that is neither one thing or the other. But then I was reflecting on that and I was like, but maybe that's great to be neither one thing or the other. So is that where you come from?
I think that's exactly where I'm coming from. I'm very interested in Cartesian dualism and like the mind-body separation that kind of has really underpinned a lot of how our societies operate in the West. And I think one of the legacies of that we still have is wanting things to be in silos.
Yeah.
So whether it's around music, where we, you know, decide, oh, all these things are in different genres, we're going to separate them out, or dance styles, oh, these are separate things. For me, there's actually no separation. When I see Dance of the Diaspora, I see the patterns. I see, oh, this is coming from the same root source. This is activating the same channels in the body. Yes, it might be like a different expression, but I understand the roots are the same. And I feel that way about Afro-diasporic music too, which is why in my DJ practice, I'm, you know, I'm blending all these different styles together, because to me, they're coming from the same root source. So fusion might not be maybe the word I would use now, but just a way to kind of talk about this kind of entanglement and meshment that actually is around it all being the same thing. But just in our Western view, we see them as like, oh, but these are silos. So what are you doing putting them together?
I think, that's lovely. Those words, entanglement and enmeshment. And I think, you know, there's some really fantastic theoretical perspectives that talk about those terms as well. So I've got so many questions, but I'm going to try and, because you mentioned, and I know we haven't got loads of time, but because you brought up your DJ work then, I thought I'll pick up on that. So I think this is probably the thing that when I heard about your work, I was sort of in a way most excited by, partly because I think for me, as I've got older, a little bit how you describe the thing of sort of finding pleasure in movement as a priority rather than necessarily the strict training grounds that I grew up in. How the dance floor, the club dance floor, the party dance floor is like such a space of freedom for me. But I also, I guess I have a specific dilemma there as well around having grown up a lot going to reggae dances. As a white person, now that music has its own sort of historical reference point for me and for my body, that's like this kind of shortcut, but I'm a shortcut to that place of pleasure and joy that we're talking about, and the bass music, but I'm now very conscious, literally and metaphorically, around taking up space in that, you know. And so I suppose I'm interested in your thoughts on that, but also just the bass, this thing about the healing potential of bass, because that's something that I really resonate with. I'm like, where does that, how does that sort of manifest, or how do you share that, or kind of, I don't know, the whole thing I'm fascinated by. So I don't know, I'm not asking a very good question because I'm getting overexcited. So wherever you want to start.
I mean, I love bass. I love bass music so
much. I know, right?
It's so good. I think it started for me, I mean, probably quite a young age. I mean, when I look at the science behind it, and I'm very early in my stages of really understanding different approaches into it, but thinking about, you know, the heartbeat when we're in utero.
Yeah.
And that being this constant kind of bass frequency that we're receiving, it just feels to me that bass, and really allowing my body to be absorbed by this, to absorb those frequencies, just kind of provides a reset. I really feel like it opens up the lower kind of energy chakras in the body, in my body anyway, and allows for things to move, which can be a really nice counterpoint, an important counterpoint to the very kind of, you know, like neck up energetic experience we have living in Western hyper-capitalist societies, where many of us are not even really feeling or sensing into what's happening from our neck down. So I love that about bass music. And if I look again at my ancestors and the way that bass and drums also have played such a crucial role in communities of the diaspora, especially around resistance. You know, all these music styles like dancehall, for example, was created because the colonists had banned drumming because they understood the importance of it for communities in Jamaica, for people who were enslaved. And so they banned the drum. And the reason you have the dung, dung, ka, dung, dung in dancehall is because people started to use big sticks to make the noise. And you have a similar thing around the development of steel pan when they banned drums in those parts of the Caribbean, and then people started to invent, you know, new ways of actually accessing those polyrhythms and those frequencies. So I see it very much as a site of resistance, and something that gives me a lot of energy. So yeah, I think that accessing base is really important. And I was just thinking yesterday actually that I'm quite keen to explore different containers where that level of like subwoofer experience can be accessed without it always having to be in a club.
Yeah.
I think club culture is very important. I'm definitely invested in trying to create more dance floor spaces and party spaces where I feel like I can really express and let go and have a healing experience. It's not something I think that is always very accessible.
No, indeed. Yeah.
In nightlife, because again, of our relationship to pleasure and hedonism and the way that people, I feel, use those spaces a lot of the time to actually disconnect.
Yes.
To become less conscious
of
what's happening in their body and of the ways they're relating to other bodies.
Yeah.
So that can feel quite frustrating for me when I'm looking for quite a specific kind of experience to really drop in and get into my own experience and my own, the places that are blocked or maybe need to move. And instead I have to be busy with people bumping into me constantly, not really respecting my boundaries and just generally acting in a very entitled way.
Yeah.
And that can definitely feel frustrating. So I feel like the club space is incredibly important, but I believe needs a lot of reforming if it's going to have that kind of healing potential. And to actually go back to, again, the roots of what club culture was birthed within, which again was around resistance and celebration and joy and being able to feel safe enough to really be welcome and to let things go in the body, which we feel quite far away from a lot of the time as this has become quite commodified and often quite a depoliticized space for people to just kind of disconnect. So I love the club, but it needs a bit of shifting. And the nights I put on are kind of trying to create the dream version of the club that I would like to be. What else to say about base? I mean, bringing it back to what you shared, this might be unpopular in this day and age, but I'm just trying to get better at just saying what I really think and not caring so much. I think that to me, when it comes to taking up space in a cultural art form, the question is always reciprocity. I don't think that for me personally, there aren't any rules about, you know, whose bodies should be there or not. It's more about how are those bodies engaging with other bodies? Is there respect? Is there care? Is there reciprocity? And I think that's the most important thing. And if maybe that's not available, or if people aren't able to really interact in a way that supports that, then I'd say, okay, maybe consider, should I be in this space or not? But if that love can flow, if that respect is there, if there's an honoring of the ancestors and the lineage, I think that's the most important thing.
I mean, maybe it's interesting actually that those two things that you're talking about actually really connect, don't they? Because it's kind of, as you're saying, often in those spaces, there's sometimes that degree of hedonism and people that need different kinds of lubrication, as it were, to kind of let go. I've never sort of needed that. I've always been pretty stone cold sober, and because I find it so intense already, those experiences and those feelings. Well, I'm loving your utopian club space, and I hope that I hope that that manifests, you know, and starts to pollinate. I think that would be great. It's inspiring. So actually that kind of links, I guess, nicely to my next question around, which is, I mentioned to you about this podcast as well, this idea of futures, and I know imagining other futures, and I know your work is influenced as well by Afrofuturism, which again is such a, it's such a sort of generous and inspiring kind of framework for thinking through issues, I find. So my kind of vision around this podcast of like, what would it take to get to a future where dance was more taken for granted sort of practice? As I said to you, we make a cup of tea, we get into our bodies, you know, it's sort of like something that we do. And maybe those club spaces are part of that as well. But I wondered, like, what would that look like for you? Are there any, like, whether it's little practices or, yeah, spaces or ways of being that you think would kind of invite that future a bit closer?
I love this question. Guess I'm gonna kind of make a statement, I suppose, that I will get to the question. I think that future already exists in certain parts of the world.
Yeah, that's great news.
Dance is not a luxury in many parts of the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. Like being in Brazil, like dance is a daily part of life. It just is.
Yeah.
Yes, there might be professional dancers who make their living from it, but people dance, you know, and in other parts of the world too. So I think if we're talking about the West, though, like kind of Northern European context, I would hope that there would be more of a prioritizing of joy, not in a kind of commodified sense, like, oh, these clothes will make me happy, or if I get shit faced and drink like all night, this will make me feel good. But like, what does it look like to really prioritize feeling good in one's body, noticing what feels good in one's body, and actually like making efforts towards experiencing that on a daily basis? So I think, yeah, I hope this could happen, and I hope that efforts to kind of decolonize would get more specific around this body disconnection piece, so that people's efforts are not just kind of in the policy realm, but really coming back to this really daily practice of, am I even noticing what the sensations are that I'm experiencing? Like when I read the news, or when I'm going about my day, like, am I checking in with that? Okay, if I am, oh, maybe it's overwhelming. Maybe I need to do some grief work and like release it and have more spaciousness. Maybe I need to really dance and allow other things to move that way. But to start thinking about, how we treat our bodies and moving away from them as machines, and really feeling into them as these incredible, sentient, mystical, vessels that can do a lot more than we give them credit for in a kind of Western framing. So I'd hope that, by that perspective shifting, that dance and just different forms of movement would become more common, more part of daily life. I also think, I don't know, I've been meaning to write about it for years. I think I still will, but in my brief little moments of doing professional dance work, I'm just struck by how abusive the dance industry is. I think there's a lot of normalized abuse, again, from looking at human bodies as if they're just machines. You know, if a choreographer says, you jump, I meant to say how high, with no regard for what my capacity might be in that moment. I remember reading an article about a woman that had just, a professional dancer who just found out she was pregnant, but was working with a choreographer. And this choreographer was telling her repeatedly to throw herself on the floor, and she was just meant to do this over and over again. And with this fear that if she interrupted that or said anything, that she might lose her job.
Yeah.
And this is exactly why I want nothing to do with the professional dance industry. I'm very much around cultivating a personal practice that for me isn't commodified, because I think this industry is actually quite sick and quite broken and isn't reproducing care or reciprocity in ways that actually support life. It's still a hard thing, I guess, I'm going through, of working out like how to legitimately center dance in my life if it's not through money, but that in itself is, I think, quite healthy. So I'd really like to see the dance world shift so that those who are allowing their bodies to be used for the service of someone else could actually have more agency and more ability to really say what they need, and for that to be taken seriously rather than seen as a threat to someone else's power, or potentially a means to which they're going to lose their job and their sustenance.
I think it's really important that you raise that. I think I guess I'm aware, because of the circles that I move in, of like more and more people trying to address those, you know, that toxic kind of systemic problems within the dance industry that you mentioned, but like all of these things, like change is slow from the bottom up, and there are certain, yeah, they're almost like sort of ways of thinking that are just these tropes that are just like the water running through the rock, and they've been they've been there for so long that it's, you know, redirecting that flow of energy in just the thought processes that people even engage in, you know, which I see in students and etc. Of around, yeah, how they relate to their own bodies, how they think about their own bodies, or what it means to be a dancer. So it's, again, it's a big issue, isn't it, in capitalism, of that individualistic and scarcity, and sort of if I admit weakness and vulnerability, someone else is gonna pop up and be stronger and be like, well, I'll do it then. You're gonna be, yeah. So yeah, all of those things are really, really central to change. But yeah, there are some good projects bubbling away where people are addressing that. We've talked quite a lot about joy and pleasure and those, finding roots to those in the body as well, which I think is the resistance that can happen on a daily basis, like you say, so important. But just to touch on, well, it's hard to touch on such a huge topic, but I guess on the other end of that is the grief that you mentioned. So you said sometimes it might be about feeling that grief and needing to move through that. And I had a look that you did a piece called The Grief Portal, I think, during the pandemic. Some film work, and I wondered if you could just talk about where that came from, I guess, and was that specifically, because we talked a bit, didn't we, about how the pandemic had quite an impact on movement work and movement practitioners, but what was your route to that particular piece of work? Was that pandemic specific, as it were? Was it around channeling it in that context, or just bigger?
No, it was actually around a process of grief that I went into in 2017. So the pandemic was quite an interesting time for me, because I'd already been grieving quite heavily for a couple of years.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it went from kind of personal grief into kind of collective grief. I was like, wow, this is really meta. And I'd, you know, just started this research project with the Global Environments Network, which is coming to an end now. Of researching, yeah, embodied grief practices and making this toolkit for them. And I started working on that in February 2019. So it was just like really incredible timing.
Yeah.
Very fated, it seemed. But yeah, in 2017, I was pregnant and for various reasons decided to get an abortion, and was sent into a pretty deep grief spiral. Lots of rage, lots of just being so shocked that this is such a common experience in many parts of the world, and yet there's no public space to really talk about it. You're just meant to kind of, I don't know, you know, put yourself in a corner and deal with it.
Yeah.
Or you have these kind of really basic comments, some of which I even received from my own family, of like, oh, well, you've made the right decision, as if like that's that,
yeah,
done,
job done.
You know, it's either meant to be this binary, if you made the right decision, so have no feelings about it, or
yes,
oh, but you love this baby, so you have to have this baby.
Yeah,
that was not my experience. Like, those extremes were not my experience. It was so many shades.
Absolutely.
So many things. Yeah. I loved being pregnant, I know I really want to have kids, but the situation I was in was not right. I'm also aware that being a Black non-binary femme, you know, being in the situation I was economically wouldn't have allowed me to parent in the way I wanted to. And I knew that I'd receive a lot of stigma, actually, in the society that we live in. So there was a lot going on there, and I really had to create my own kind of practices and tools in order to be with that process. And it's really been many, many years of navigating it. And so I was thinking about that a lot, and then talking with Nessie from the Global Environments Network about grief processes and the work I was doing on myself to try and, yeah, work with it. And that's when the kind of project came about, and I started to do the research. And then during that time, I think Performing Borders Live reached out and said, you know, would you like to do a piece of work for us. And I thought, yeah, I would love to actually translate some of this stuff I've been busy with into a film context, and you know, with some slight sci-fi overtones, since I just love sci-fi. And in the context of the pandemic, yeah, it just felt very important, because I realized, oh, well, it's not just me having this personal experience of grief. Now we're in this collective moment, and whether or not people identify the need to do it, I feel it everywhere, and I'm seeing it everywhere. And so the grief portal was just a little offering, maybe, for people to just come into contact with what might be moving for them, and to think about ways they could, yeah, either physically move with that, or be with their grief in some way.
Yeah, I think what the thing, one of the things I really wanted to pick up on there is what you were saying about this thing of sort of feeling more than one thing about things. And I think that I guess it's interesting in relation, like I often say to my students, when we look at dualisms and binaries. So this is really interesting to me, actually, in relation to my reaction to the word fusion. So when we look at, because I'm like, when we look at these binaries, often the thing that's most rich and interesting is the thing that's in between. It might be the thing that's not, it might be the thing that's not said as well, between those two things. So sometimes it's like, here's the binary or the dualism you're being presented with. There's all this other stuff going on in the relationship between those things. That's actually where the, that's where the juice is, if you like, or the richness of that experience, I guess. And so, yeah, this thing of feeling more than one thing about something is so important, to acknowledge the full complexity of being a human, because it's really hard. In these times. And also, I think the, yeah, the sort of potential for your practice and your creative practice and work to be a channel for that, that is, you know, I again, transformation is a word that I have a problem with, just because me and language, but it's only because it's been used too much, I feel, in a way where actually maybe we're not really we're then going, oh, it's been transformed, but actually it's still it's still tangly, I guess. Yeah, maybe the entanglement is again a better term there, but that certainly on a personal level, moving through things and transforming things through your practice, you know. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I'm like, how to wrap this up, but what, so I guess I'd love to hear, like, what you are working on right now, or the next thing that you're excited about. Yeah, I'd love to hear about the now, I guess.
The now is juicy and definitely transitional, because I've been in Berlin for 2.5 years, and now I'm in Amsterdam. I moved 3 months ago, so I'm quite
fresh.
Yeah, it's very fresh. It's been a kind of big move and big new job starting all at once, so a lot of change. So I'm really excited to kind of just create some nice rhythms and rituals for myself in my flow here, and work out what that looks like. I am writing a book I'm hoping is going to come out into the world by 2023. Just to kind of synthesize a lot of the themes I've been thinking about, working on, and I suppose, yeah, giving some context to why I feel like we need to build what I'm calling ecologies of transformation. So I know you don't like the word. I know you don't like it.
Yeah, but in your case, I'll let you off. I think it's rich. It's obviously going to be very richly considered. I'm just only talking about it when it's kind of, it's usually stamped on it from the outside, from a government agenda or something like this. It's not.
Yeah, I hear you.
Coming from a very different place.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to that, to really. Yeah, just getting some ideas down on paper and having a way to kind of honor this chapter, because I feel like I'm often just doing things and moving towards what interests me, and I'm now becoming more aware of, like, the beauty of archiving and actually the importance of that,
especially
in the moment we're in now, where there is a lot of interest in social change and social transformation. But the way that's often happening and taking place is still very extractive. with people, I guess, needing to survive, needing to meet their survival needs, and not necessarily being able to take a step back sometimes and to understand, okay, does my need to pay rent sometimes get in the way of my values around how I'm trying to, move through the world? And maybe if I'm inspired by this thing I hear someone say, I could cite them or, you know, give some kind of map to show the inspiration and development of my ideas. And I crave that a lot. And so I'm thinking, well, it's about time I really do that explicitly too and show the lineages that I feel connected to and the ways that I've been shaped by them and the thoughts that thoughts and conversations I'm having, I suppose, with those theorists, with those ancestors, and to just put that out in the world, but also to archive and to also give myself a little bit more a little bit more permission to really say, yeah, this is what I'm about, this is what I'm thinking about. So that's what I'm mostly excited about. And then the new program I'm running is really beautiful. The group I'm working with is so lovely. Just excited to get into more of a rhythm with that and make the time to, also weave my projects on the side and figure out what to do next, because I'm just more and more drawn towards music. Then I also really want to still dance. So there's, a lot moving. I'm just trying to be patient.
And not start too many things at once and jump into these things, like you say, but actually ground in the kind of layering of how they can also be part of that body of work, I guess, which is what the book will do as well. I found a ton of I've got so many notebooks like in my loft, like this, just found this like ton of notebooks from working as an independent dance artist in the community for like over 10 years. And even then, like, computers were less of a thing. And so it's these scribbles of endless sessions, you know? And so, I've been reflecting on how and if it's even possible to archive any of that in a way that's like meaningful. And it's not even necessarily about it going out into the world, but I will really look forward to that book. And I think anyone that takes on writing a book, I'm just full of awe. Because I've written a PhD and afterwards I knew that there wasn't a book in me. I'm really wish you all the best of that. And just give a shout out to the name of the course that you're running. What's it called?
It's called Ecologies of Transformation.
Is it a master's program?
It's at Sandberg Institute in Amsterdam.
Amazing. So just for anyone who wants to check that out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's been a total pleasure and joy, and you've given me loads of other things to think about, which is always, the best thing about these conversations. So thank you for your time today, Camille.
Thank you. It's been really nice being in conversation.
So, hi, I've got Luca and Robin with me here.
Oh my God.
Hello, we're back.
Back for our little digestif of the interview this week. So I first met Camille at a party in London at the London Psychedelic Society.
Wow, what? Tell me more about that.
Well,
what is that?
I was going to say, it was a lot less kind of out there than it sounds, to be honest, because it was a children's party.
I was partying with Camille.
And they'd booked that space to use it because it was a really cool space. But anyway, I'm sure they do interesting work. So that aside, tell me, what reflections on my chat with Camille? What came up for you, or what jumped out at you?
I really loved this thing they said about this utopian club, because I really have an urge to create the space that I want to be in. I think they said it really well. They said it a lot better than I did. But yeah, I love that. I'm going to make this space because this is the sort of space I want to exist in. And that's really cool. And also that's sort of where I exist in dance now, is more wild, free, maybe a little bit intoxicated, like madness, less self-conscious. And that is so liberating and pleasurable. And that was the running sort of theme, wasn't it? That, like, finding pleasure in your body. Maybe I don't feel like I was ever that, like, trained. Obviously, I did a degree here. but, like, maybe I don't feel like I was that strict to my body ever. So that I loved, yeah.
The relationship to hedonism that they spoke about was also sort of really intriguing, because I think there is a sort of way that we maybe, that thing you said about being a little bit intoxicated, like, it does help people to lose inhibitions and break down barriers, but there's a tipping point often, and how can we create ways to kind of access that without that as well? Is that even possible? And I genuinely feel really lucky that for me it totally is, but I know that that's not the case for everybody, so there's always this desire in me to, like, share that or help other people to get there. That sounds really patronizing, but just to kind of be like, actually, it's a shame that there's so much stuff built up that we need those seven beers.
I was thinking about how you can create a space where people can come and they can be totally sober if they want to, if that's a lifestyle choice, or they just want to be there to enjoy the music. But there's also not the judgment for the people that need a little bit of something to get them buzzing and get them going. Because we sat in this room are very lucky in that we do dance all the time and we're always thinking about dance. So for us to step into a space.
Yeah, I mean, there's another really interesting strand to Camille's work around harm reduction and drugs policy in relation to events and stuff like that, that I really recommend taking a look at on the website, on their website.
I think I wanted to pick up on what Camille said about not having a dancing body as a commodity and it being something to be sold and kind of used and abused in many ways. And I was thinking about how I'm still in dance training and thinking about what I want to do when I graduate. And yeah, from the get-go, I think dancers now, I hope, and we are having conversations about it, thinking about as soon as we graduate, not saying yes to the first opportunity that comes along that could be potentially harmful for our mind and body and future careers, and being a little bit more savvy about what people are asking of us from the very beginning. Because on the on the contrary, I would like to make a career out of dancing and I would like to be paid for what I love to do, but I know for other people that's not what they want, so
yeah we've had a lot of chats about, like, knowing your worth, haven't we? And being like, just because I've there's this thing of, like, when you go into the industry you're gonna get treated like shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, and that's just what you have to do. And we had a chat, I remember, we were, like, sat on the beach, oh my god, idyllic, being like, I'm gonna go straight in. I'm gonna be like, hi, I'm Luca, I'm an absolute, I love, I'm not saying this about myself, hi, I'm Luca, I'm an absolute force to be reckoned with, and you're gonna fucking love it. Like,
yeah. I can, it's a bit of a tangent, but have you ever seen
that
film?
We love a tangent.
Oh my God, we do.
Have you ever seen that film Whiplash about the drummer?
Yes.
And I couldn't watch it because it infuriated me so much about how his teacher taught him. I wouldn't have stand for it.
Yeah.
I would have
walked out.
Got up, snapped my drumsticks on my knee and gone, done something else.
Yeah.
And I think people respond differently to different pedagogies, and that's just one, and it's a very old school, harmful way of teaching. And some people have come out the other end of it and had fantastic, amazing, incredible careers and gone, I couldn't have got to where I am today if it wasn't for Mr. So-and-so when they beat me with a stick. <It's> like, but, like, I don't want that factor.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when you say, like, some people respond to that, like, is that ever okay?
Yeah.
You know, I really remember being prodded in my stomach by my ballet teacher when I was, you know.
Yeah.
And he's
like, achoo!
Oh, bless you.
We also love a sneeze. We love a tangent, we love a sneeze. This is laugh. But what Camille was saying about their ballet teacher and kind of going, I think it was coming from a place of love, but actually it's not okay. So I think that's a really lovely way to think about it, as well as being compassionate for those people also having
you know, been handed down these sort of damaging tools and not knowing another way. So it's kind of a reciprocal process again, isn't it, between student and teacher, or the learner and the giver, and how we can feed back that value or what makes us shine. You know, I'd like some more of that, please. You know, when you do that, it makes me want to expand into that. Yeah. Or that, you know.
The other thing I wanted to mention was Camille's experience with ballet. And yeah. I've just come from a ballet class, you can probably... we're in a very small room. and I love ballet. It's sort of where I started in my dance training. And I feel really sad when I hear other people's negative experiences of the art form. And the conversation that you had with Camille made me think about how can I reconcile this immense joy that something gives me, that for other people it's either an inaccessible space or a space with an immense amount of prejudice. And I kind of have to recognise that in a ballet class, in a ballet performance, I have an immense amount of privilege, that I was blessed with long legs, high arches in my feet, and an understanding of line, and I have the right body size. I'm also white, I'm also a man, and I can put in half the amount of effort that any of the girls can in the room and get a big round of applause for it. And it's like...
you're a rare gem.
But yeah, it's a
like
really
you say, there's
complex...
like some tensions there, aren't there, to like reconcile. And that's, yeah, I think the fact that you recognise that is like a big part of the battle.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think though also there's something about, I'm glad you raised that, because I was thinking about ballet as well. And just in relation to, I think because it's the most... Unfortunately, we always refer back to it as the thing to kind of move against, because it's the most kind of codified and established discipline in dance. And in a way, that's part of the problem of the kind of colonial impulse. It's like, let's talk about some other techniques. They're also not going to be perfect. There's going to be issues there with the way that they've been potentially circulated too, but we don't have the language, and we don't have the documentation, and we don't have, because we always refer back to ballet because it's, you know, the oldest white European kind of form that we, you know about, basically. So some of that is to do with not having anywhere else to kind of look for these alternative models that are both positive, but also things that we might look at and want to change or rebel against. And so ballet always gets that. And I think one of the things I was going to say as well is that ballet's never, very rarely looked at from a somatic perspective, from the inner world of the person doing it. And that's partly, again, because of narratives around pain as well and the difficulty with that. But I think narratives of joy, of finding joy in ballet, would actually be a really healthy, positive thing to add into the discourse, you know, and the embodied experience of it. And women who also have experienced great joy through ballet dancing. So... yeah, it's definitely great that you raise those complexities and come here as someone going, I love doing ballet, I'm sorry.
I think it's hard, isn't it? Because like I don't love ballet at all. and we sort of always base ourselves in it, don't we? And I guess maybe I didn't question that properly. And that just sort of made me think like, yeah, why does it always come back to ballet? And that... is grounded in such a place of privilege. And you know, Camille talks about dance hall, and because you brought up reggae, and and like, do I take up space in this? Like, am I sort of allowed to take up space in this because it feels like not my space, right? And they said about reciprocity.
Yeah.
Good word.
I was like,
how do I say this?
How many syllables?
Where did the sizz go? But yeah, that was really interesting. I don't know. To be honest, I don't really have a point. Just that it's all very interesting, and it's a lot to think about. And I think as people, you know, like, especially with certain forms of dance and art, as you know, white people, I think it's really important that we recognize where it comes from and the history and the weight to those spaces. But yeah, no, I don't really have a point.
No, but I think what you said there again about this thing of feeling like you can be in a space, and that really relates to what Luke was saying about like having the right kind of body to be in a ballet class, whereas we might have experienced quite a different thing in a ballet class of not having the body, you know, just for the listeners, Robin and I are both fairly...
We got girls.
And we're not the... Maybe you could say we're not the tallest of people.
Oh. I don't know, really.
I was going to say myself. Vertically challenging.
No, I was like,
it's okay for me to talk about myself like that.
No,
I don't want to include you. So, yeah, so like that feeling of not belonging, it was very present for me in that. And hey, do you know what? Not being able to do the splits. We've got to go back
there.
Oh my God. We've got to find a way to get that in every single episode.
Yeah.
So, so that thing, yeah, belonging is really important, isn't it? And I guess it's then how you make space for people who don't feel like they belong and how you hold that space. And as Camille said, sort of honouring the people who maybe... do belong and don't belong. It's how, yeah, creating these inclusive environments in different ways. That is our mission for Dance Futures.
Yes.
Should you choose to accept it, young people, out there, and the older people too, but you know.
We need you.
We need you. Join us. All right, that's a good note to end on. Join us. Let's create the dance futures that we need.
Hi, me again. Welcome to the first Geek Out of Series 2. But for those of you that are new to the podcast, this is the part where I pick up on some themes that might have arisen and kind of channel them into my own research in terms of dance scholarship and writing, which is a very underrepresented sort of form of study. And in fact, the paper that I'm looking at this episode also sort of makes that point. So I cannot get enough of the title of this paper. I'm looking at Nigerian academic, writer and publisher Bibi Bakara Youssef's work. It's called I Love Myself When I Am Dancing and Carrying On, Refiguring the Agency of Black Women's Creative Expression in Jamaican Dancehall. Now, oh, I'd love a good title. Honestly, it kind of, it's one of those things that can really make the difference between you wanting to read something and not. And playing with language and titles like that is one of the geeky things that I enjoy. So this one definitely caught my eye. There are loads of things I could have picked up on in Camille's interview, but this one kind of underpins some of the themes we talked about around taking up space. Also, bass music, hedonism, and of course, the dances of the African diaspora, which are so influential to Camille's practice. So my highlighter pen was well worn at the end of reading this, I can tell you. but I'm just going to restart with a little quote. Youssef is talking about the fact that a lot of the study of Jamaican reggae and dancehall culture has traditionally focused on the DJing, the lyrics and the music, which has also tended to be aligned with black male transcendence and also textual analysis. So she writes, an overemphasis on discursive and representational regimes cannot adequately address that which is visceral, invisible or pre-extra discursive. Continued focus on the lyrics occludes an account of women's contribution to the experience of the culture. Contribution to and experience of the culture. She goes on, therefore, what I find potentially subversive is less what Cooper calls the verbal marronage of the DJ's manipulation of language or the misogyny and homophobia in the culture than women flouting conventions and refusing to be civilized. They transform the dancehall space into a gynocentric space. This transformation of space, according to Carol Boyce Davis, becomes women's own version of the carnival of resistance. I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm just floored by that. The idea of the visceral and the invisible, which is like something that dance scholarship has had to grapple with for so long, but how we kind of value that or don't, depending on the kinds of work that's being done in a particular area. And this idea of a gynocentric space, I mean, that is blowing my mind right now. And she uses the term transformation quite a lot there as well, which is something that came up in Camille's interview. And I think one of the things that she addresses, though, as well as the kind of overemphasis on some of the male practices in dancehall and Jamaican culture, is she's really careful not to just associate these transformations with joy and pleasure, although she really does want to acknowledge that the kind of eroticization and joy in the Black female body is a huge part of dancehall women kind of exposing and enjoying their own power and sensuality. She also makes a real point that this is always attached to pain and always against the backdrop of a kind of socio-political context of oppression, but that is almost also a driver for how these women can sort of channel and change their experiences. There's also a great passage in it where she talks about the argument around objectification and uses another dance scholar, Sondra Horton Frehler, Dance and the Lived Body, a book which I highly recommend as well, a discussion of how the body and the self are never kind of separate. So it's sort of, she makes the argument, impossible for them to become purely objects. And that with these women are aware of their objectification, using it as a strategy to assert their subjectivity in the moment of dancing. So it's kind of an intentional lived experience. So although never without problems, those kinds of arguments, I think it's a really important part of recognizing agency, actually, for women to create these spaces. The other bit that I absolutely love is this description of some of the clothing, where she writes, paying homage to the goddess of cellulite. I mean, amen to that. So, and Youssef goes on to talk about the sort of cutting and slashing of these items of clothing to kind of let flesh spill out, and how, what a difference that is to the kind of Eurocentric, white, civilized kind of idea of a woman's body. And so in that is that carnival of resistance that first quote talked about. Again, I'm really aware that there probably are some generalizations in there, and that I am talking about it from the perspective of reading this paper rather than my own lived experience, which is obviously very different to the women in this article. So I don't want to make any assumptions other than I really celebrate the permission in a way that gave me to think about my own body and women's bodies. And I think it is something that some of the dancers of the African diaspora can offer us, can offer the world, really. So yeah, I love myself when I'm dancing and carrying on. And the temptation to reduce forms like dancehall to pure hedonism or egoism, or somehow to do with kind of machismo prowess, etc., which it did move away from the more sort of spiritual aspects of Jamaican reggae music, she writes, but she says that's sort of a way also to dismiss some of the like revitalizing aspects of dancehall culture. And another thing that I really love is the idea of something being both banal and profound at the same time. So she talks about kind of everyday practices and how those things that might seem quite kind of ordinary, like the rituals of getting ready to go for a night out, are also sort of ways that we find to express our identities. And perhaps that's stating the obvious, but in this particular context and in many of the kind of day-to-day struggles that marginalized groups are having, it's easy to dismiss some popular forms as nothing more than that, I guess. But dance is not a luxury, and neither are those things. They're important parts of bringing to bear these sort of creative expressions on difficult experiences, I guess. And that's the key point that Bibi Bakare Youssef is making.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this month's episode. If you're hungry for more, please follow us on Spotify at the Dance Futures Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram at Dance Futures Podcast for more behind the scenes goodies and updates. Thanks so much. Bye.